parished, and I had served 6.5 years east of the Suez Canal in Egypt, India and China. As a matter of fact, I spent 3 years in northern China at the time of the nationalist and communist revolution in Shanghai in 1925, 1926 and 1927. There was only two of us in the regiment. There was a Sergeant Major Fryett in B Company and myself in D Company. Who had ever been out in China before? He was with some other British regiment, and the events that I've just described in regards to the revolution in Japan was something that he, Sergeant, Quartermaster Sergeant Fryett, experienced. While he was having that experience, I was in northern Japan, northern China, with the 1st Battalion, the East Yorkshire Regiment of the British Army. And I was there for almost 4 years.
What was your capacity? What was the British Army there for?
The British Army was there on, it was concessions granted to the various national armies going back to 1842, the end of the Opium War. Concessions were granted to the various nationalities that took part in this event: Russia, old Russia that is, Japan, France, America and Britain. Britain, of course, they were all part of the old, what we know now as the old colonial system, exploitation of foreign peoples. And as a matter of fact, it was at that time that I participated in manoeuvres with this English regiment in a place called Shanaek 1, northern Japan, although I was barracked in for the rest of the year in Tinsin and Peking, alternately. And it was during my experience in Shanaek 1, on the Great Wall of China, which at that point jutted out to the Yellow Sea, that we used to come across groups of Japanese who were also manoeuvring in the Chile Hills on the Great Wall, part of the Great Wall of China, was the province of Hopai, and on the other side was part of the Gobi Desert. And the going into the hills and coming out of the hills early morning and late at night, we'd often meet regiments of the Japanese. of course, as soon as the officers in command of both parties meeting each other head on would draw the troops to attention and salute each other. The Japs usually had the rising sun white background flag at their head, and after the ceremonies were over, then the Japanese would really reveal their feelings with regards to English troops, colonial troops, and that's what we were. And they would tell us in those uncertain terms, that in a very abusive manner, by the way, that they were going to kick the hell out of us sooner or later.
And this was about 1930?
This was in 1925, 26, 27. And this was the first experiences I had with them. Now, we were what we call, what soldiers generally recognize as, a spit and polish outfit. This was the part of the discipline, but the Japanese were entirely different. For instance, one of the first things the boys noticed on top of the wall in passing the Japanese troops was the fact that they were not spit and polish. They were being trained for regular mountain warfare, and they were well acquainted with this area. They had a concession very close to ours in Tinsin, in the city industrial areas, and were well acquainted with the industrial areas, which they later become to occupy as part of the aggressive action starting in 1931.
Mm-hmm. And how did the Chinese people themselves and the Chinese government feel about these things?
Well, the Chinese and the people of China proper, the Chinese people have always had the deep respect for them. They were a peaceful, business-like nature, and considerate to a certain degree. They minded their own business. They didn't have too much to do with us. But I will say this, that because of the disunity that existed amongst the warlords, who were puppets of the imperialist powers, the rest of the world, who were occupying their country, the country was divided from top to bottom. Sun Yat-sen was very active at that time in northern Japan. He was in Tenzin while I was there for a short while. And of course I wasn't acquainted with the philosophy that these people held at the time, but I do know that the warlords were cliques who were under the influence of both the United States of America and Britain and France and Japan, and were used in that way. We very seldom come up against political questions at that time. Of course, you had to do a lot of thinking for yourself as to what was actually happening, but you couldn't actually know what it was. And I've only learned a great deal since by studying history of that particular period. But when I eventually left China in November the 23rd, I left Tenzin the 23rd and passed through the harbours of Hong Kong, a place which I always felt I hadn't seen the last of. I was going to see it again, and I had that feeling at the time. And I was discharged in England in 1929, and 2.5 months later I was in Canada. And it was only 11 years after that I again became a soldier by joining with the local Winnipeg Grenadiers, 1st Battalion. And we were on our way to the British West Indies, and afterwards we landed back in England again, on which we were prepared for foreign parts without being without revealing to us exactly where we were going, although it was obvious we were going somewhere in the east or the Aleutians. When we left Vancouver on the 25th of November 1941, and don't forget, at that time they were discussing the aggravating situation growing up in the Far East. Anyone who read the newspapers knew that something was going on that was becoming more serious as time passed.
Did you have a feeling the Japanese were, from your experience in China?
Well, I had connected it up all right. And as a matter of fact, it was I was an instructor of small arms, and I knew darn well that we didn't have any automatic weapons other than small arms weapons. And I and others who had participated in a course 3 months before the battalion left Jamaica to come back to Winnipeg, I had taken part in a small arms course in Long Branch, Toronto, in preparations for intensifying the training of the men before they started. And hospitalizing as it may seem, it wasn't until we got on board a ship and halfway in the middle of the Pacific, and we'd been training men like nobody's business up in that time, even on board a ship. And it was a very crowded ship, but there was 2,160 of us. And my company commander, Major Hook, who's a very fine person, and the young officers that were with us, all knew that I had had previous record. As a matter of fact, I had told a general officer on a parade in Fort Osborne Barracks that I had been over there. And that at the time there was only two of us who had this experience. One of them being Quartermaster Sergeant, I think it was Quartermaster Sergeant or Sergeant Major Fried, who was killed the second day out on the Japs advancing from the frontier of the new territories in Kowloon toward, which was the only approach for a land fight, in the approach to Hong Kong. And at that time, I had already taken battle stations on a place called Wanshai Gap, overlooking, which was in the middle distance of the entire area, was overlooking Victoria and the harbour and Kowloon, which was part of the new territories, ceded to Britain under a treaty made some years ago, and which was connected up with what I understood to be as far back as 1926 and 1927, as a two-plan defence of Hong Kong itself. I was aware of the fortifications on the island, and not having at that time too much knowledge on defence works, I didn't think much of them. It didn't impress me very deeply. But and I knew that British regiments circulated in that area, in three areas of China at that time. That was Kowloon, the new territories, Hong Kong itself, and Stanley Barracks, which was the highest peak on the island, and in Tsim, where I was situated.
Were there British regiments before you
there? Oh yes, there would be British regiments there, alternating in different garrison stations since the year 1842, when Britain was wrestling concessions from China. Actually, we know, of course, that there were plundering armies that were plundering the wealth of the country, these countries, and there's nothing a common soldier could do about it, of course. But I've always remembered it, and it's made a deep impression on my mind, and it's made me resentful.
And you realize it was really as long.
Correct. And that's why I remember these things so vividly.
Did you have a foreboding?
A what?
A foreboding of things to come?
Well, I've argued this with myself, you see. I've studied this question a little bit, and I've always said that if everyone listened to their inner men, they wouldn't make the mistakes that they do. Yes, I did have it, matter of fact. I knew it wasn't going to be a happy situation, but again, I wasn't exactly sure until we got in the middle of the Pacific, when they leaked it out amongst the troops where we were going, that I realized that I was the only one with Fryett on board that was able to tell the troops about it, as a matter of fact. My own company commanders requested that I hold lectures on board a ship. Now, whether they did the same with Fryett or not, I don't know. But I know that I held a series of lectures with my own company and with other people. I had discussions with the officers as to the territory we were going, because I was well acquainted with it, and with the area and with the people.
Mm-hmm. And did you speak Chinese?
Pardon?
Could you speak Chinese?
In 1925, the beginning of 25, I began to take lessons, and I had an old friend in the YMCA in that area. It was kind of a nappy cafeteria affair, and he used to teach me. And I was able to speak, but it's the kind of language that if you don't keep it up in practice, you soon lose out. For a long time, I was able to speak, but I never got a chance to practice it with the Chinese after I left.
When you were stationed at one type gap, when you first got there, what was the first thing you had to do? Go on maneuvers?
No, as a matter of fact, I was very surprised. This was one of the things that I questioned. The Brigadier Lawson, and I'm sure Brigadier Lawson, with the my own company commander, who had become on the island, he had become second command, should have been able to utilize my services as far as this situation is concerned. Because there was a peculiar situation existed in Hong Kong when we arrived there this time on the 16th of November, 1941. As a matter of fact, there was a Japanese embassy on the island, overlooking the entire area, and was there until the day before war was declared. And this was one of the questions I always questioned. Why should they leave these people here? I don't doubt that they already knew the lay of the land and their own plans, but why give them a chance to remain there and prolong the situation? This is one thing I objected to. And secondly, as events proved, while we were greeted very cordially by the Chinese in the area, they were the ones who we employed, or the boys, the companies, the troops themselves employed to clean their shoes and wait on them and go messages. And these were the same people they employed who, after the war was over, and we were already prisoners of war behind barbed wire, who were set to guard and look after us by the Japanese. So you see, we had had a fifth column within our midst all the time we'd been there. And the situation was one in which, well, the events, the report of General Kier, who was appointed as a one-man political commission to answer one question in the minds of most people after this affair was over, was Hong Kong defensible? And he came back with one word, that Hong Kong was indefensible, and that we were a sacrifice force. So the only conclusion you could come to, that the situation was desperate during the years of Winston Churchill's bravado, when he asked of the Canadian government to allot troops as a token force in the defence of Hong Kong. Because we faced an army of close to 380,000 troops, with a distance between us of approximately 500 yards of water. On an island of approximately 70 square miles, although very mountainous in places. It was divided into two areas. The English regiments on the Kowloon side were given the job of the advance guard, and to retire slowly as the Japanese become offensive on the date of the declaration of war. Well, Japan, being such a small island, it depended upon the technological level of the armaments that were being used as to just how long we would last. Hong Kong, at its highest peak, overlooked on the west the Pacific, and don't forget that the Japs had a terrific navy at that time, and had been taught by the British over a couple of decades as navy men and how to handle big ships. And the only landmass approach that could be for an enemy making an attempt to take over Hong Kong would have to be from the China landmass, which you could look at in three different directions and see from Mount Stanley, you could see hundreds and thousands of people in all directions. As a matter of fact, there was 2.5 million Chinese on the island of Hong Kong, who should never have been there in such a political situation, because they could either be used by the enemy, or they could be used by the British, if they knew how to use them, or the defending forces of Hong Kong to confuse the enemy by throwing them in their way. And this is, don't forget, this is a warlike situation. Instead of that, the enlarged population of Hong Kong was allowed to remain there. I don't know why, I don't know how it counted in the strategy of defense for Hong Kong. But as soon as the Japs took over, they immediately marched millions of them out into the rural areas, to get rid of them, to get them out of an important area like Hong Kong itself. And this was long after taking Hong Kong, Sumatra, and various other areas, including penetration of India. It ended up as such a confusing situation because of the fact that it was impossible to defend an island of Hong Kong, which was in Japanese water territory anyway. It was in their territory. Attempt to make a direct attack at the declaration of war. They left us alone until they took Malaccan Straits, places in the Indian Ocean, Singapore itself, a number of other places, and well, they had everything tied up. Then they just simply came in and surrounded the island and said, all right, if you want to save lives, hand over. But the attitude of the general officers in charge of the island, the British officers themselves, said, well, you come and get us. And if you take it from me, they did. Within about, it took 18 days to take Hong Kong. but it too heavy an expense to the Canadian forces. It wasn't really worth it. Now, in that battle, I was part of D Company, who was allotted to the brigade headquarters, and brigade headquarters was situated on the Wanchai Gap. It's quite a lot of... Wanchai Gap was a stretch of middle land, which was hills halfway up. You know, this is middle area. And it was composed of a crossroad, a police station, and a number of roads leading from the lower areas of the battle area. And it stood to reason that with 500 yards of water in between, in the island itself being what it was, the Japs would naturally have to take certain risks, so they just simply ordered certain parts of the troops get over there by swimming, take their equipment with you. And while they attempted this from different sides of the island, which was defended mainly by the Canadian troops divided into two districts, and volunteers from the Hong Kong civilians, the defence of Hong Kong amounted to about 12,000 men altogether. And there was no way that a 12,000 defence force could possibly defend the island from a Japanese army of approximately 300,000. I also have in the back of my mind the feeling that if I remember the name of the Japanese general, I would say it right out that this general was also in charge of the troops that I met in Chiang Kai-shek some 11, 12 years previously. Now, his name was either... Well, I won't attempt to say it because I'm not... I think I know what the name is, but you see, I noticed that there was a general who was hanged alongside of a man we called the Kamloops Kid, who was himself a Canadian-born university student from British Columbia, but who at the start of war went back to... he was a Canadian-born man. He was born in Canada, in Kamloops. But he went to Japan and became a commissioned officer, and he was one of the first ones to meet the Canadian forces, and he made it pretty tough for all of us. As a matter of fact, there were two or three men who died right back here in Winnipeg from the treatment received from him and by his soldiers. He and the general were both tried and I think they were shot or hanged in Stanley Barracks shortly after the surrender. And well, that was it. But as far as the war was concerned, there was no such thing as a front. The situation immediately began to deteriorate when the defenders were on the island and the Japs were facing us 500 yards away. And it stood to reason they weren't going to just sit there and wait until we starved out, because it would be ridiculous. They made attempts immediately. And, it wasn't long after when we were informed that the Japs had broken through and they were in the city of Victoria, and they were dealing with the Japanese, the Chinese natives first, because they were the mass who were living in that area. Then they slowly began to advance into the actual battle area, which was the summons. All we know at the conclusion of the battle, which lasted not too long, that it seemed to me that a large group of Japanese snipers had penetrated our own lines. From what direction, I still can't tell you. I don't know. But they set themselves up above us at the peak of the various mountains or hilly areas. And unfortunately, they knew the layout and placed themselves in such a way that they could look down at us occupying one shelter rooms built into the side of hills. And when you come out, you immediately face the sniper's rifle. And that's where a lot of the wounds occur. A lot of the killing was done that way too. Mind, D Company itself did cover the retreat of the Scots Guards Regiment, of an English regiment, the Middlesex and Scots Guards, from the new territory frontier where the Japs began to advance on the 7th and 8th. And we covered their retreat, and there's quite a lot of killing done there too. The Scots Guard really suffered pretty badly.
How was the
system
that what you were
targeting? My platoon was 15 platoon of the D Company.
Mm-hmm.
And
how were you equipped?
Very small arms, small automatic weapons, something that couldn't do anyone any harm beyond 500 yards.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, I'll give you an example. I was on top of the brigade headquarters, and I had two groups, and I got them to set up anti-aircraft guns, what we call the old Lewis guns. Old Lewis guns were used in the First World War and were obsolete. We also had other types of guns which were a little faster, fired more rounds. But these are the attack guns were actually Lewis guns, and with a pan of 45 up to the bullet in them. And the first or second day, knowing that my troops, my companies, had not had any experience in previously firing live ammunition, I took it upon myself to order them to put the guns up, and when airplanes from the Japanese area come over, to fire at them, regardless of how high they were. Not that I expected to hit any of them, but in order to give the troops the feeling of handling a weapon. I'd no sooner done that, and two or three boys had had the chance of feeling the vibration of a gun and how to fire and how, what it feels like. Then I was yelled at from below. Underneath me was the company commander's office, who gave me an order to stop that bloody firing. What do you expect to hit? An airplane at 25,000 yards up? I said, no, I don't expect to hit any. But I've got troops here who have never fired a live round in their lives, and I've got to give them the right to feel the feeling of a gun. Don't do it. The general orders are that you do no firing, no offensive action in any way. So we dismantled them. There was no use for us there. But we stayed around for a while, and we kept troops off with these automatic weapons like Tommy guns, Sten guns, Bren guns, and Lewis guns. But the only 75 Howitzer that I ever saw was in charge of Indians who had been brought over from India, or were British troops living in Hong Kong as part of the Hong Kong General Local Defence. And they fired in the direction of the Japanese. The only thing I never heard of any damage being done. I was in a position where I could review the whole of the new areas with a number of people. We were just in a hopeless position. We were part and parcel of a sacrifice force that no possibility of ever withholding an enemy from taking over if they wanted to take over. I'm convinced of that. And I was convinced long before General Crayer made his remarks about what the results of his investigation was. That C Force was a sacrifice force, and that Hong Kong, under the circumstances, was indefensible. Now, I agree with this because in the first place I was well acquainted with the fact that the British had found themselves in a terrific, untenable position, that all they could hope to do was to give to bluff the Japanese in the hope that they'd be able to hold them off and so on. Now, why was the Japs able to cover such a huge area at the beginning of the war that they did? Well, first of all, the Japs had the job in the First World War as a close friend of Britain, so-called, to patrol the so-called colonial empire of the Far East, or in the name of Britain. And when it comes to the Second World War, the Japs had already decided, we are not going to do any dirty work for anybody else. If we're going to do any dirty work at all, we're going to do it for ourselves. And that's why they did exactly what they did, because they had already knew the area they were going to take over in the event of war, but they waited until they were sure that Britain, France, and other countries were engaged in Europe. This was part of an axis agreement between Hitler, of course, and Japan. And I joined the armed forces because I had the experience, and secondly because I was against fascism. I was an anti-fascist.
Mm-hmm.
And I've always said that I was not a conscious anti-fascist.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't in favor of fascism. And I was against it, and that's all. It's the only way to prove it.
Tell me, when were you captured?
Pardon?
What day were you captured?
I was captured on the 25th of December 1941.
Where were you at the time?
I was in brigade headquarters. I was at brigade headquarters at One Shy Gap.
Were there many? I heard that there were some of the officers who killed by the rest.
In that area, yes. As a matter of fact, there was a number of situations that was not the fault of the troops or even the officers, in my opinion. Transport, the raw element of the Canadian Army, deputy untrained for such a venture, which in Britain, in the British old colonial army, used to do in a 21-year period. Now, let me explain that. In the trooping season which Britain had with the circulation of our troops in the old colonial empire, they used to send a battalion of soldiers out from my regiment, for instance, East Yorkshire Regiment, embark from Southampton on the 22nd of November 1922 and went to Egypt. They were in Egypt 2 years. Then they'd go to another area. And they continue going from each area, changing over from one peacetime garrison to another, until they reach the Far East. And by that time, they've gone through a certain number of time zones and climatic conditions, and they've gradually become acclimatized to the weather. And this is something that didn't happen with Canadian forces. They were taken off the farms. In fact, there was 400 men who were definitely men. Meant to be discharged, and were forced into our outfit as volunteers, and actually became part of the Hong Kong outfit after very poor training conditions and without heavy armaments, technological level of firepower. This was what was lacking, but the forces themselves were not the type of forces well trained to confront an army who had already been fighting for several years in China, and were well-armed war warriors in every sense of the word. And that helped. That didn't help the situation any as far as we were concerned.
Can you tell me something about your capture and your experience in the concentration camp?
Well, don't forget that the Japanese army had never taken prisoners up until the time they met us in Hong Kong. As a matter of fact, they'd slaughtered all the prisoners. Treated the Chinese terribly, and they never attempted to penetrate China proper. They always took over the industrial areas that they were acquainted with, and because this was where the mass of the people lived. Don't forget that China was an area of, it was a peasant economy, and the industrial areas were coastal cities in the main, and they were well acquainted with it. By being occupiers of various areas, what we used to call military political commissioners, areas where that were granted to various nationalities under treaty by the president and by the enemy, and treating the Chinese was a terrible thing that the Japs committed, but when they come up against us, we had to, the officers there apparently immediately had to embark upon making them understand that they had also signed what was known as the Geneva Convention. They had made no attempt to put it into a practice until it was pointed out to them what would happen in the event of the conclusion being reached one way or the other. And the result was to give us the jobs of building up the camps in the form of huts and barbed wire, and then walking in the door and closing the door afterwards to become the prisoners. because they had never taken prisoners previous to that time. In this regard, we were fortunate. But then, on the other hand, there, according to reports that we received at the time, they did some terrible things. They took the revenge on a lot of our troops before they finally accepted us as prisoners under the Geneva Conventions. Now, the treatment melted out, of course, when they had no footsteps. An army ordinance issued by the Japanese government to the troops in this area a few years previously had instructed the armies in southern China to live on the land. They themselves didn't take food from various areas of Japan and to send to the troops to feed. They said, feed where you meet, where you're fighting, where you meet the Chinese, you eat right there. So you always eat at the expense of the Chinese masses. Isn't it that what happened? And they adopted this as a system. So they had no supplies when they came to us. They had groups of pills which they used to take once in a while in order to give them a feeling of having had some to eat. But when they got to Hong Kong and took Hong Kong over, they took 3 years of rice supplies. They refused to accept parcels for nearly 2.5 years from the International Red Cross to supply us. And so we had to live the same way as they lived. And I want to tell you, my experience throughout from Hong Kong to Japan is that we fed as poorly as the Japanese people did themselves. And the Chinese people too. And conditions couldn't have got much worse. I think that we lost almost as many troops in the after we become prisoners of war as we did while we were fighting.
And what you were in a divided, like you were in the officer's
side? No, I wasn't. I was with the non-commissioned NCOs.
Oh, NCOs.
Yeah.
And were you separated from the ordinary men? Or were you
no, them? I was with the men throughout. Yeah. I was with the men throughout. Everything that they took, I took. But I was a little more fortunate, and I must point this out. And the medical officers have always said about me that I wasn't as badly damaged as most of them, and I can only explain that by the fact that I was a regular British Army soldier over a period of 7 years that travelled the near and far east, become climatised, and was able to understand and take. My mind had already absorbed the shock of what was there. The Canadian troops, on the other hand, had never even in any way been well trained physically as well as psychologically, and when they got there, the blow was harder on them than anyone else. And as an example, I'll give you just one example: a young lad in my own company, my own platoon. He's a farm lad from Saskatchewan, Saskatchewan. He's obvious a boy that was brought up on a farm. He looked like a farmer, even in uniform. But he was a tremendous, intelligent kid, and him and I took to each other, and I eventually found out that the thing that he liked more than anything else in life, and the thing that he missed most, was his family, naturally, and horses, farm horses. And he showed me pictures. He never showed me members of his family. I never saw members of pictures of his family, but I saw lots of pictures of his horses. And you see, what I'm trying to show you is the love of certain people for the land and for the instruments that they use. And these horses he worshipped. And he nearly died while he was sleeping alongside of me in a number of occasions on different prison camps. And I had to, at times I used to volunteer to take cookouts for chiefs. Why? Because in this way I could clean the pots out after all the rice had been shared out. I could clean the pots out, put it in little cigarette packages, and bring it back and feed these kids. And he was one of them that I used to particularly look after, because it seemed that he'd been so well fed during his early life that this is the thing that hit him mostly, the fact that he couldn't get enough to eat. And it affected him psychologically. And he went to skin and bone. But he still looked, you could tell he was a typical farm lad, well muscled, and strong determination, very honest, very quiet, but then very sincere. And I thought I'd better take care of him, because if I didn't, we'd lose him. Well, I want to tell you, 3 months before we were liberated, he was taken away on a spot check for tuberculosis. And after he come back, I could see he was altered in some way, but I couldn't explain it. And shortly after, we were separated again. And when I got back into Winnipeg after liberation, I first inquired about this boy, but I found that he'd gotten liberated all right, was on board of a troop ship, but he'd been buried at sea, as having died from tuberculosis. This was the outcome of starvation, nothing else. And this is the thing that typified Canadian lads who'd never gone through the experiences that I had been fortunate to have met up with, and which practically saved my life. Well, I went down, yes, I went down from 174 to about 105 pounds. But I was... I haven't got it. But after it was all over, I still maintain that my experiences in the Far East, my training in the army before I joined up with the Canadians, had saved me. And everything that the boys got, with the exception of diphtheria, which a good many boys in the prison camps died with, I got dysentery a couple of times, very badly. And one thing that I got that I'd never had in, nearly 14 years previously, was a touch of malaria. I had had malaria previously, and I'd never thought I'd get it again. But I got it in Hong Kong. I was treated for that, and I was treated for a skin disease, and hot foot, and what they call red eye. All these are various troop expressions of diseases that you can get in the Far East, and very, very, very definitely. Now, they have affected my eyes, affected my body, but I've taken care of myself since, and I think I've been able to make a comeback, excepting for my eyes. And that's fine. For not knowing for how long the war was going to last. At first it used to be, well, over those hills from North Point Star Camp, we're expecting Chiang Kai-shek on a big white horse. Come with all these millions of Chinese to liberate us, which was ridiculous if you knew had a political situation. But however, you know, Canadian troops don't have any political, they're apolitical, and this is the unfortunate part about it. And part of our training should be political, because in your mind you then you reach the stage where you know certain things are going to happen, and you begin to accept them if they're inevitable, or you think you have an idea to evade them, so you make every effort to evade them. But on the part of people who have been pushed into a situation where maybe they knew that they were prisoners of war and they wanted to get out of it quick, and they thought that all the forces in the world were now going to concentrate upon Hong Kong in order to liberate us, I could have told them that wasn't going to be the way it would be. That there was a showdown between powerful forces in the world, and that show wouldn't be over, and we wouldn't be liberated until it was completely over. And one side or the other side was defeated. And this is the spirit in which I went into the army. And I accepted it. Mine had gone also through the First World War, but in a different situation, but I felt the impact, not of war battle conditions, but of civilian treatment. It was what you had on your mind at the time that depended upon whether you would live or die through such a situation. And while the NCOs and officers did a magnificent job in convincing everybody, we are anxious to take every man we can home with us, the fact of the matter was that before this began to dawn on them as an organized campaign should be organized of this kind, many of them had already shown signs under the condition we existed with the Japs, that's working 10 hours a day and very hard labour on a bowl of rice twice a day, was not a very happy situation. And every man, there was no man that escaped very, and the results of it. And with people who are not used to that kind of thing, then of course, naturally, it has a very deteriorating effect. And I can sympathize with the Canadian troops that went overseas and didn't have the advantages of troops that were well-trained and well-prepared psychologically for the war efforts. Now, my job as an instructor in small arms, the use of small arms for troops was the thing that I did mostly during the war. And I always told troops that I trained that the Canadian people expect you to be trained well enough to be able to defend yourself and get at least a 50% chance of defeating your opponent wherever and whenever you meet him. But there was no 50% chance in this particular situation, and there couldn't be once we were committed. So you do the best you can. And I think I've always said in one of the last reports I gave the company commander, Major Huck, was that as far as the men are concerned and the Canadians are concerned, they have nothing to worry about. They played a terrific part. And I'm very happy about it. The thing that I was disappointed about was one of the first things you usually do with troops entering a new period in entering an area where there's going to be a potential battleground, you take them out for familiarization purposes. The officers got that treatment. And I thought that I have been there before, should have been given the same opportunity. Because no one else was acquainted in the entire force over there with the fact that I was well acquainted with that two defense plans existed for years and years, which were alternated every 5 years. The fact that these two plans were not put into effect, excepting maybe one of them partially, was because of the situation that existed. And the type of situation that existed. And the type of thing that we were confronted with. First of all, the army was in excess of anything necessary to take such a small island, so weakly defended. The fact that the Japanese themselves had already surveyed the situation before they made their attack, or even before the Japanese army appeared, through their embassy. And the fact that they used a lot of the Chinese in Hong Kong as a fifth column. We were defeated before we ever got to Hong Kong, if the truth is known. And that's why General Trier could come to no other conclusion but the one that he did.
Did you go to Japan?
Yes, I did. I was in Japan some 23 months. During that time, I was in 5D, the prisoners of war camp, just outside of Yokohama, and then about 6-7 months before the end of the war, I was taken with about 500 Canadians, and we were shipped to a place called Ohashi in northern Japan, about 80 miles hinterland from Sendai, which was a northern port. And in that area, I worked with a lot of the boys in the iron ore mines, which was a terrible job. I never thought I'd ever get out of it. And as a matter of fact, I was sick there once or twice, and they changed my job, and I became a blacksmith helper to a group of Japanese in Ohashi, not in Ohashi, but outside of the camp in the mine. And I suffered with all the diseases that most of them suffered with, excepting diphtheria, and in that respect I was very, very fortunate.
And do you think the Japanese, were that not that cruel? Is that actually their treatment? Was their way of life?
No.
I think that the Japanese troops are deliberately and were deliberately trained for this type of savageness in their treatment of other forces. There was a bitterness about them. They hated the. They called us. They thought we were English. As a matter of fact, one of the expressions of abuse that was hurled at me and others of my type in the outfit that I'm describing to you in the beginning of this discussion, when we were marching in or out of the hills and being passed by Japanese, after the courtesies had been passed, then they turn around and call you. Well, one expression I have used before is that they'll say, "All right, you English bastards, we get you." Now, this was only 6 years after, before they began the war in northern China. And the situation there, and by the way, an interesting fact too, is that no invading force of China landmass has ever succeeded in penetrating the hinterland. Never, in all the history of China. And the reason is that the Chinese are such a huge mass of people that anyone attempting to go any further than the industrial coastal areas immediately becomes merged with the general population. When I say that, I say it because it's generally troops that are as savage in their treatment of people as the Japs were at this particular time, involve themselves with the women that they find, they rape them, they do everything else, and they either live with them or use them or kill them off, and that's what they did in Hong Kong too. But they never proved to be victors unless they are able to take the coastal areas, industrial areas, and then if the authorities are able to lay down demands to a centralized government, then that's what they do. But they never penetrate the interior, because if they do, they'd be wiped out. They'd be wiped out by an overwhelming mass of people who you can't fight. And that's the reason I believe that no one will ever be able to defeat China. Now, I say this without recognizing the fact, of course, that today there are other means, technological levels of armaments that could do a different kind of a job if it had to, and I hope it never will come to that. I'm against war, always have been, but there are wars that you've got to recognize may be justified. And I feel that wars of liberation, wars of freedom, no matter what form they take, are justified as far as people are concerned. If they don't like what I'm saying here, we can always wipe it off the map.
That's fine. That's fine.
Yeah.
Okay. In the blacksmith shop, there was about 7 or 8 of us went into the blacksmith shop, and we were all allotted one blacksmith, who was Japanese, and a couple of blacksmith helpers. Well, I got to know the people that I was working with, and there was one particularly, Koma, he used to call himself. As a matter of fact, he didn't live in Ohashi, but he used to go home every so often, and he went home at one time, and he was always the lad was pulling jokes on, especially on prisoners. Of course, we got to know each other. More or less, as far as you got allowed to go, because you'd always get slapped down if you went too far. And I got slapped down 2 or 3 times, but the kid used to pull things on me by hiding my hammer. And I'd look around, and here's the blacksmith pulling a red hot iron out of the fire, putting it on the anvil, and waiting for me to smack the to work on it. And I didn't have a hammer. Now, where'd you put your hammer? But I knew that he had played a trick, and I used to get pretty mad about it. So I used to have a small hammer, and Koma wasn't around, so I couldn't do anything but try to explain to this chap that I didn't have my hammer, that Koma must have hit.
So I got mad and I threw my hammer across the, my small hammer across the back of the shop. Of course, when the Jap saw that, he recognized immediately that I'd lost my temper. And here, Akuma comes out again and he says, yes, I got your hammer. And he showed me the hammer. But they, by the way, the Japs themselves grabbed hold of me. They might have thought I was going off my head. But they grabbed hold of me and then they started whacking me. So I didn't say anything, I took it. And then they said, all right, explain what happened. So I told them that, well, here's the blacksmith pulling out an iron and I'm supposed to smack him, I haven't got a hammer. And I know who's got the hammer, where he's put it. But where he's put it, I don't know. But they didn't, they thought that I should be able to take the joke anyway. So a couple of them worked me over for a while. And that was that. There was other instances of this kind which were...
Would you believe that Karamo did this maliciously?
Yes, he would do it, yes. Not deliberately. They have a sense of humour that is rather peculiar.
What about the time when you couldn't go to work and they made you go? You said that your arms were getting...
Well, there was two or three instances of this kind. But anyway, Koma and I were quite friendly. And he also used to sing songs, and I'd sing along with him, you know, try to sing in Japanese, because you tried to get along with these people, because these are the ones whom your life depended on, as a matter of fact. And Koma and I got along very well together. I used to get a lot of information from him. And the day after the bomb was dropped in Nagasaki, I got the information, and I got it through Koma. Now, they have a very peculiar, as I said, they had a very peculiar sense of humour, and you had to recognise it and go along with it, because if you didn't, you come up second best anyway. So I did, but I used to get plenty interesting information, and I knew that the war was coming closer to an end, and that the big bomb, if it had scared them, they could scare him. Then apparently it was a dangerous situation. And this was the first question I asked after the armistice had been signed and we were expected to be liberated. And along the road from Ohashi to the little town that we were outside of, came a man who I had known previously. And this was Ken Woodsworth. Woodsworth of the NDP's, his son. Or his nephew, he lived in Montreal, as a matter of fact. But he had come out as a reporter in the field. And we asked him what this big bomb business was. And this was the first word we got about the whole thing. On top of that, of course, I was with a group of men in a valley in the hills of outside of Sendai that they didn't know where we were. They were looking for us for quite a long time. We were the last ones to be liberated, as a matter of fact. They couldn't find us. But when they did find us, eventually, we were bombarded with all kinds of equipment and whatnot in oil tanks sealed. And one of the two of these, in being dropped, were dropped very carelessly by the American flyers, that one or two of our prisoners were killed. So this was, kind of a...
Liberated
They liberated them, all right. Okay. My medical officer, what's his name? Captain Crawford. I was given the opportunity of backing out if I wanted to, because my left ear had become perforated. I told him at that time that I wouldn't back out. I'd been with the boys from the beginning, beginning of their training, and I would go along with them. Now, at that time, of course, we didn't know where we were going, but I had a feeling we were going somewhere in the Pacific. That's, however, she had a pretty tough time of it too.
When you were this blacksmith helper, did you get better rations? Did you ever have a chance to scrounge around and get a little extra for yourself or for your men?
right from beginning to end, I didn't make any attempt to do this, although a lot of the boys did, and I don't blame them for it. But I want to tell you that I always hated rice. As long as I can remember, I've never liked rice. But when they started serving it up the way they did, I liked it even less. And I want to tell you that in the first 6 months of my imprisonment, I didn't eat at all. Now that may sound surprising, and I don't blame you if you don't believe it, because a lot of people haven't, and I know why they haven't. You see, if you've lived well in civilian life, ram your head, go through a situation like this, where there's no food, or the food is irregular, or it's entirely different to what you've had previously, your body then begin to eat up the fat that your body has accumulated, and it's exactly what happens. And everybody loses weight during those particular periods. And this is exactly what happened with me. But in order to soothe my nerves during this particular first 6 months, I did have little money with me, and I sold my watch, and I sold a number of things that I had, and the money that I had I used to buy cigarettes over the wire from the people whom I accused of being fifth columnists. And I paid as much as 10 Canadian dollars for a can of 50 cigarettes, and that's when I smoked. Well, when I felt hungry I used to smoke. And we didn't just smoke the cigarettes as we took them out of the can. I could get three different cigarettes out of one cigarette in a can of like that, because we used to use toilet paper and mix it with other things too, and then smoke it so that it would last longer. And all these kind of things I resorted to. And I can only remember eating once during that first 6 months. I happened to get a fatigue job where it was dry, not rice, the other fluffy stuff.
Barley.
That I got a few grains of barley. And I must have kept that barley for about 2-3 weeks, because I used to take one or two seeds of it and put it in my mouth and hold it there until it fluffed up. And that's all. And smoke it. That's all. That's all I ever had for the first 6 months. But then I realized, when they put us to work, and we took a mountain apart, a mountain in Kaitak, where the airport is now. We leveled that entire place from a huge mountain that was there, and there must have been anything from 2,000 to 3,000 men working on it. And we worked on it for quite a long while, and they worked on it after we went, of course, but we nearly cleared it out before we had to leave, and I was on that job for about 23 months. And we used to level it off. It was red soil. And we lay it out for a stretch of about a mile. And that's where the Japanese built the Kaitak Airport. And that's completely flat now. But we flattened that out. Yeah. That was the first job we did. And then they shipped us out from there to Japan.
So you had to eat to do that labor.
Well, this was the whole idea. You see, I got an appetite and I had to eat. If I hadn't have eaten, well, I would have died, that's all, because there was nothing else. And you can take any kind of attitude you like, but I'll be quite honest with you. I wouldn't have missed the opportunity of going back to Hong Kong, even if I'd known that I was going back to Hong Kong. I wouldn't have missed it. Why? Because I've always had a philosophy of life that people must meet their experiences, good or bad, because otherwise you're not living. And with that is my philosophy. I've never tried to get out of anything. And in fact, once I've been committed, I've refused to get out of it. And that's why I've always taken that attitude. And I don't regret it. I don't regret it. I think it was a tremendous experience for me to be able to go back again and live the life. But I wasn't utilized to the extent that I should have been, as far as my knowledge of that area is concerned. And this is the only thing I'm sorry for.
Tell me, what did you do on your return? Did you go to work?
Pardon?
When you returned to Canada, did you go to work?
No. It took me 18 months to recover. My job was waiting on me, by the way. Mm-hmm. I was a union organizer. I've organised all kinds of unions in Winnipeg in the last 30, 40 years. I'm well known amongst the trade union people in this area. And the last five, it took 18 months to go back on my job, but my job was waiting for me when I went back anyway. And as a matter of fact, the last 5-6 years of my experience, I retired from the University of Winnipeg. I was the gym manager. And this was a job I enjoyed very much, and it gave me an opportunity to build myself up, and I worked at it, and I enjoyed the kids' companies and the problems and everything else on it. I wouldn't have missed that for the world either.
Did you hear from your wife in the camp at all? Did you hear, get any letters?
Letters? No, I did not. As a matter of fact, the last letter I wrote, I'd already made an increased assignment of my allowance to the wife to increase her income, because I knew she couldn't. It must have had a pretty tough time for what she got. But as soon as I got to Shamshapu, which was the camp on the Kowloon side, which we occupied right after we disembarked, I asked the quartermaster sergeant to increase the money that I sent to my wife by about $20-$25. And I wrote the letter, I put some money in it, and I mailed it off air. I actually saw the aeroplane going over Hong Kong, going back. But that never landed there, because the Japs were already getting prepared to go over to Pearl Harbor. And they must have crashed this plane before they got anywhere, because she never received it. And the result was, by the way, there was also records, quartermaster records from the regimental headquarters that were on the same plane that didn't reach England, Canada either. So there was nobody got any benefits. But you see, the only thing that I was worried about was the fact that she must have been having the time of it. She was. Otherwise, it all accumulated anyway. And I got it eventually, pardon me. It went through Russia, and that took Vladivostok.
I sent the best of everything, but by the time it got there, you got very little of it. Socks that his mother knitted. His mother was still alive at the time. And soaps, all kinds of soaps. The best, you know, chocolate bars. But by the time it got there, I don't know how much.
Well, some things had obviously been rifled in it, and I had expected that that would happen, but we were in such a terrific mess in the camp that we were in. We had an hospital full of prisoners of war who were dying, and we used to capitalize on that with the Japs to try and negotiate medicines and whatnot, which they wouldn't give us anyway, they didn't have. And therefore, any parcel we got was automatically shared up amongst those who needed it most. And I handed over to Captain Reed, who was the medical officer in this particular camp, in number 5, Yokohama. And I gave him, I know that he himself asked for razor blades. He wanted razor blades. He didn't care about chocolate or soap or anything like that, but razor blades he must have. So I gave him a package of razor blades. And then I handed over some bars of chocolates that were in the parcel, and soap. And there was one or two other things, but I forget what they were now. But this is what we did, and everybody did the same thing. And the hat too, as a matter of fact.
So the best came out of the men despite the circumstances.
Pardon?
The best came out of the men despite the circumstances.
Yes, we had very rare did we have incidents that would reveal a man as being other than cooperative to his fellow man in this position, because we were all in the same bucket. And if one went down because he didn't act according to rule, then we'd all go down. No, I can't remember of anyone that I would say would be unworthy of the
escape. Did you know about the escape? Were you in North?
Yes, as a matter of fact, I was nearly, by the way, yes I did. I was in that camp, and I was sleeping opposite Tommy Payne, who was a local boy, he made a set of chessmen, carved them out, put on an exhibition by the Free Press shortly before we left Winnipeg. And I knew of the plans. I had listened to them, although they tried to keep me out of it too, but I was in the same hut as them, and we were all NCOs in that particular, that at that time. And I heard them discussing, I knew what was going to come, and a couple of nights later they just simply disappeared. And the fact that I didn't see them around, you don't ask questions when the Japs come around. And when a bunch of Japanese officers, high officers, came around, and I was sick in bed, and I was alongside of Jim Toms from Transcona. And I was really sick, and I was facing the harbour with an open window, and I coughed an awful lot. My broncho began to take effect. This is where I really got broncho, as a matter of fact. And when the Japs came up, these Japs came up, they whipped the blanket off me, suddenly. And they examined my legs. And the place was lousy, and I had been scratching. So they immediately examined these scratches to see if it had been caused by going over a wire. And I thought for sure I was going to get hell. And I was in no position to take it. So they asked me questions, how about those scratches, where they come from? Were you part of this plan to escape? No. Did you know anything about it? No, I didn't. Well, they couldn't do anything because they could see it was scratching. You see, I showed them that I was being scratched and I was sick. But I remember the incident
very
well.
Did you think they must have had a boat?
They did have a boat. You see, some of them used to go out, all of them were young lads. They used to go out on forage, not foraging, but we called them foraging trips, but they were actually being used by the Japanese to bring back flour and rice from the hordes in the godowns in the town. And when they'd meet various people, they talked to various people because they were, well, they were meeting with them. They had Chinese still doing work around there, and their contact was made from this group with these contacts that were making on their daily forages. And they got this boat, yes, and they climbed the wire, five of them, and every one of them were captured in the middle of the harbour, making way for the mainland. But don't forget, the Japs are very subtle people, and our people were pretty gullible not to think of it. But for miles around that area, on the mainland and beyond the 25 miles of new territory, the peasants, the Chinese peasants, were all people who were allowed to hold their farms on condition that they provided information to the Japs. They were part of the fifth column setup, and they were the ones who revealed the situation, apparently. And even if they got on shore, they wouldn't have been any safer. I thought of the plan beforehand, but I wouldn't have taken anybody else into confidence, because I would have said I couldn't afford to go with anyone else. If I had had a map, I'd have made an attempt too. After all, why not? We were made to understand that you get to a certain area, and if you know China, you know how to get along with people. The Chinese were anti-Japanese, definitely. Why? Because of the treatment they had received. And if you got far enough away from the influence of the Japanese in the industrial areas, you would have found Japanese who would have taken you to military Chinese military headquarters and civilian areas where you could have made your escape. But the Japanese had it tied up tight, that anyone attempting that kind of a business was taking it pretty hard, especially the higher the boat. And there was five of them, and they kept together, and it wasn't good enough. I regret very much, as a matter of fact, that they didn't confer more, because the Japs immediately turned round and made the officers responsible for dividing the entire camp up into groups of five, and each was responsible for the other. And if one disappeared overnight and was not accounted for, the whole five would be taken out and shot. The whole four would be taken out and shot. Now this is the policy, this is the tactics they use to discourage anyone from trying to get out.
Very clever.
Yes. And the result was that we got to know only quite some time later that there had been no public trial, there had been a public execution. and all five of them had been decapitated. I was sorry about that because Tommy was a tremendous personality. He was straightforward, clean-cut, honest, and a good soldier. But
how did you feel about this trial after the war?
The trial of
Tugby and
Tugby and Harvey. Well, I knew both of them. I was in the camp with both of them all the time, and we all knew that there was monkey business going on. And Tugby himself was an SOB, a real SOB, and he utilized everything for himself, and he would sacrifice his fellow men. This was one of the few instances that I experienced during this particular situation. And he revealed himself as a pretty rotten element, all right. And as far as I'm concerned, mind, he didn't really suffer. His benefits were delayed for a number of years, but he received everything. I understand he did. And Harvey, I had no sympathy for him either. He really played a rotten game too, as a matter of fact. They collaborated together with the Japs. That's all you can say about it.
Well,
they
what collaborated. Was them to collaborate for? To spy on their own men or what?
Yes. They were there, they had the spies amongst the men, on men who would report them, various instances going on amongst the men, and they themselves were ready to co-opt with the Japs to the fullest extent as far as work parties are concerned or revealing any plans for escape or anything like that. These are all things that take place in camps of this kind, this big groups of this kind. And if you know the Japs, they're a pretty subtle bunch. Mind, they're good soldiers, but this is the way they're trained. And ours weren't trained, unfortunately. I always make comparison because I think it's by comparison that we operate. We should operate.
How do you feel about them now? Are you bitter at all? Or
not in the least. Not in the least. No. This is part of life's problem. Well, it depends upon what you mean by bitter. I have no bitter feelings as far as the experience is concerned. And I'm not the only one. And others were, unfortunately, much more unfortunate than I was. I'd had the experience, I knew what I was going in for, and I knew what to expect. Of course, I would have preferred not to see it. There was no benefit, no advantage. It was only a humiliation of Britain, as far as I'm concerned. Maybe she needed it. I couldn't see anything good for the idea, but I think it's ridiculous.
Mrs. Sarah Watson, 274 Selpig Avenue, Report Delivery, Winnipeg, 8450. Official information has been received from Tokyo, Japan, through the International Red Cross Geneva, that Active Staff Sergeant Charles Watson is a prisoner of war at Hong Kong Camp. Stop. Further information follows when received. Office IC Red Road or something.
Yeah, now read something now. Anything else that
there? There's another one. Oh, this one, yeah. That's a letter from.
Put the date on it, please.
Yeah.
There's no date.
Mm-hmm.
My dear Sarah and Linda, hope this letter will find you and a baby in the best of health. I'm doing as well as can be expected after a small wound, now healed. Tell Mom and Dave I'll see all is well. Give best regards to all our friends. No need to worry about me. Take well care. Love, may write again later. Charles.
Captain Hutchison on an attack
with a small party on what we call a police station right at the crossroads of Wanchai Gap. And when we got there, the Japanese were already there waiting on us. And before we knew it, there was about a dozen hand grenades thrown at us by shadowy figures that we couldn't distinguish, but we could see the shadow, dark figures darkening here and there, because they didn't know how many there was of us attacking. And we didn't get very far. We got to the bottom of the stairs, and that's all. But I had always been dubious about this particular police station. Well, I'd never been in it, even during the time that we were reconnoitering the area. I had the feeling that the police at that time were part of the 5th Column group, and that they were already in possession of that in the event that on the declaration of war they would immediately come into action, providing they had radio permission by the Japs themselves. And but I went with Hutchison because it was a question of attempting to do a job. And it was, well, Hutchison never told me that the orders had come in from headquarters. This was the orders he had, and I was the one that was picked to go with him. So we went, and we made an attempt to go up the stairs in order to investigate the police station, but we were fired on before we got anywhere at all. But we did get to the bottom of the stairs, and then we all flopped because there were so many hand grenades being thrown at us. And I got a bit too, but I don't want to mention where I got it. as a matter of fact, it was a very strategic point. The police station itself looked directly down the road where our headquarters was, and any activities in that area could be spotted by anyone who was looking from above down the road. As a matter of fact, when our party went back again, I advised that we walk on both sides of the road, close to the edge of the road. And it's just as well that I did, because as soon as we got close to the hill where the kitchen was, there was firing directly coming in from the police station right down the road, centre of the road. And if any of us had been marching, as we would usually have normally have done, we'd all got killed.
That's where an experienced soldier comes in.
Yeah, that's right. This is one of the things that a general who visited the regiment before we left, we were lined up on the parade square at Port Osborne Barracks, and for some reason or another, he stopped in front of me. And Colonel O.M.M. Keir, the Crown Prosecutor, was the Colonel in charge, with Paddy Draper behind, and the company commander, and a couple of lieutenants. And he stopped in front of me and he said, "Have you ever been in the army before?" And I said, "Yes, I did 7 years in the British Imperial Army." "Oh, and where were you?" I said, "I was in Egypt, India and China." And he said, "How long were you there?" I was 6.5 years east of the Suez Canal, and I give him the dates. And then he said, "Colonel, did you hear that? Now this is the kind of man you've got to look to." And he says, "If I were you, I would advise you to tell your men, when you get wherever you're going, to follow this man." A number of people heard it, stand alongside of me as a matter of fact, but that's what surprised me.
You were badly frustrated because you were capable of saving a lot more lives.
Yes, I felt that I could have advised them on a number of things, but all I was allowed to do was to prepare the troops for the place they were coming to and what to expect when they got to Hong Kong and Kowloon. Mm-hmm. And the thing that I dealt with because of that was the diseases that I knew young lads could get into trouble when they got to areas like that. Because, you know, I've walked down the streets of Hong Kong and I've had good-looking girls come to me and hand me a baby. And one asked me, "Do you want her? You can have her." Oh, God. Chinese. And I've known and seen these things. One of the things that I saw in Peking years ago was Chinese carrying their children to a wall that used to ward off the river, and they'd put the baby on the wall and then stand there as if they were looking into the water, and when they thought no one was looking, they'd throw the baby into the river.
Mm.
Because at that time, baby girls they didn't want, baby boys they wanted for their armies.
God.
A lot of people find that very hard to believe. I don't blame them, but I've seen it with my eyes.
That was the old.
There was a law, an unwritten law in China while I was there, that anyone who touched a dead body, no matter who he was immediately responsible for burying it. I myself have walked across an area where we were manoeuvring, and I found a basket. I know it was pretty naive. This basket seemed very familiar looking, and it looked like a cradle without wheels or anything. Of course, it was just a basket with a cover on it. So, without thinking, I pick it up and look at it, and here was the body of a dead baby. This is what the Chinese used to do. Mind, I'll tell you, China was one terrible place to live in for people. Famines took millions of lives. Natural floods, natural disasters were very common, and it swept people away by the hundreds of thousands. And they weren't regarded as a serious matter.
Life was cheap.
Cheap, too darn cheap, that's right. As a matter of fact, you know, if the truth is known, the only true value we have in this world is life, is people. People are wealth.
Mm-hmm.
Without people, you couldn't do a thing, you couldn't create anything or do anything.
Right.
People are wealth.